lit. At the same time, Nelson's team moved to a safe house owned by General Dostum, located several miles from the fort. Spencer and his team hired local workers to paint the walls, fix the plumbing, and tile the floors. As if a spell had been broken, the health of all the men improved once they moved out. Mike Spann and Dave Olson moved into the fifth floor of the Turkish schoolhouse, along with several other paramilitary officers. Mitchell, Bowers, and eight more Special Forces soldiers lived on the third floor, with the local interpreters on the fourth. The second floor became the operations and support center, occupying what had been, when the Taliban lived in the building, a mosque. Sensitive to the fact that he was using a religious space for other purposes, Mitchell was savvy enough to ask local Afghan clerics for permission to do so. Permission was granted, and his Afghan colleagues in the building appreciated the gesture. Brains before bullets, thought Mitchell. Outthink 'em, so you don't have to outshoot 'em. The ground floor consisted of a tiled foyer, a large cafeteria, and a functioning kitchen that had running water and heat. Workers taped cardboard over the windows that had been smashed by the Taliban. Electricity was provided by gas-powered generators that broke down on a regular basis, but were repaired by Afghan workmen using, it seemed to Mitchell, little more than a hammer and a piece of duct tape. He marveled at their good cheer in the war's aftermath. Life in Mazar, it seemed, might begin to assume predictable rhythms. Sergeant Brad Hyland of Dean's team sketched a diagram of a barbecue grill on a piece of scrap paper, and Atta's men built one from spare metal they scrounged in the city. They butchered a cow, and Hyland next taught them how to grill hamburgers, which they'd never eaten. Chief Warrant Officer Cal Spencer of Nelson's team enjoyed watching the antics of the local children as they teased Garful, an aged Afghan who'd been assigned as one of the team's bodyguards. Wherever Spencer went in the city, the children often trailed close behind. Spencer had to tell them that he was busy and that they should leave him alone. He was trying to be stern, but this was hard. The kids wanted to shake his hand. Garful was less tactful. He would charge at the kids, waving a stick. "Leave the Americans alone. They have things to do." The kids would jump away and laugh, and Garful, looking over his shoulder, would wink at Spencer and smile. "Holy cow," thought Spencer. "Garful's like us. He's making a joke." Spencer and Garful started laughing. But this familiarity aside, increasingly, out in the city streets, the teams found themselves thrust in the middle of family blood feuds that had been left to simmer during the Taliban occupation. And there were larger, more violent ethnic battles to contend with. Six of Atta's men were killed in a gunfight when they tried to prevent some Hazara soldiers from stealing a taxi driven by a Pashtun man. Even though the driver had done nothing to the Hazara soldiers, he happened to be a member of the same ethnic tribe as the Taliban, and this had awakened the Hazara's bloodlust. Atta's men had prevented the robbery, but at great cost. Such incidents were becoming more frequent. One faction of fighters kept asking Dean and Nelson to bomb individual dwellings, claiming that each was a Taliban safe house. Without exception, the men would discover that the house did not belong to a Taliban soldier, but to an old enemy of the group that had requested the airstrike. Dean started calling this attempted assassination by bomb. It was clear to both him and Nelson that the sooner they put the city back together, the sooner the Afghan soldiers might lay down their arms and re-enter civilian life. Amid the ongoing conflict and the wreckage of war, however, there were other signs of life, including desire itself. Wherever he went on the city streets, blond-haired and blue-eyed Sergeant Brett Walden managed to draw a crowd among the women in their veils. They walked past him in their burkas, upright and stiff as giant thumbs, faces hidden behind a fabric screen that fluttered in and out with their breath. Walden was shocked when one woman beckoned him with a wave. "Come here." He walked over, and she lifted her veil, just a peek. Her beauty stunned Walden. He realized that he had stupidly assumed all the women were ugly, just because he couldn't see their faces. This woman would have been stoned by the Taliban for this very behavior. Walden tried discouraging it. The team prided itself on being culturally sensitive, and it was inappropriate for him to see any Afghan woman's face. But the problem only grew worse. Some of the women started removing their veils completely and making eyes at Walden when they passed him on the street. Dean nicknamed him Casanova. Walden blushed whenever he heard the word. He also began to fear something bad would happen, either to him or to the women he met in the street, if he was caught looking at their uncovered faces. At the same time, the experience made him appreciate the plight of these women, many of whom had been beaten by their husbands simply for being female. He guessed this was their form of silent protest, a flirtation with a man from the outside world. From his new office, Mitchell oversaw the rebuilding of the hospital and its water and electric plants, and supervised the disposal of unexploded bombs and landmines that still littered Mazar's airport and streets. Working alongside him was his friend Major Kurt Sontag, who had helicoptered into Mazar from K2 after the Americans had ridden into the city. Major Steve Billings, who'd been running the team's operations from the comfort of a desk back at K2, arrived too, his worst nightmare realized. The war had gone on without him. With Billings was his buddy Sergeant Roger Palmer, who was equally glad to be entering the war zone, and an eager young captain, Paul Severson, 30, from Lake Zurich, Illinois. None of these men had lately fired a weapon in a battle, if at all, and all of them were glad to have escaped the monotony of K2, which, in the preceding weeks, had grown by several thousand men. It was now a tented city, populated by soldiers from all branches of the U.S. military, and they had been waiting for Mitchell, Dean, and Nelson to capture Mazar. Over the coming weeks, they would now enter the country in follow-on maneuvers. Just as they had planned, Mazar was a base from which the rest of Afghanistan could be controlled. The battle to win Mazar had proven decisive. But Mitchell, Dean, and the others all knew that the Taliban were still at large by the thousands, and that Mazar could be lost almost as quickly as it had been won. With such uncertainty in mind, Sergeant Betts, who had also flown in from K2 to staff the new headquarters, began fretting about the schoolhouse's security. The building was approachable from all sides. Betts worried about its close proximity to the busy street, an easy target for would-be car bombers. Such an attack could deliver a devastating blow. Mitchell's feeling was, don't relax yet. With the temporary cessation of major military confrontations came the sudden yet murky game of strategic brinksmanship, with men, weapons, territory, freedom, and American dollars as the chips on the board. And soon, Dostum made a move. Ever the wily diplomat, he lured a Taliban arch-rival, Mullah Faisal, deputy defense minister and commander of some 10,000 Taliban troops, into Mazar to negotiate the terms of his own surrender. If Dostum could achieve this surrender, he would decrease the enemy force he'd otherwise face in Kunduz and add more soldiers to his own ranks. He had set the date for his movement to Kunduz as November 25, so time was of the essence. On November 21, 11 days after he'd driven the Taliban army from Mazar. A gloating Dostum welcomed the doer-defeated Faisal back to Kala-i-Jangi. Faisal roared through the fortress gate in a convoy of about 40 vehicles and 500 men, all of them heavily armed. They pulled into a parking lot inside the fortress walls, and Dostum's men instantly surrounded them. As each side stood with its guns trained on the other, the portly Faisal, his head wrapped in a black turban and dressed in a brown sport coat, marched up to Dostum's chambers to discuss the terms of surrender. He was trailed by several dozen of his own gunmen, who took up positions around the room. The room was tense. As a show of Dostum's strength, helicopters from the U.S. 160th SOAR, the same unit that had delivered Nelson and Dean into the country, patrolled overhead as the two warlords talked over tea and biscuits, with Bowers listening quietly in the corner. Dostum leaned on Faisal to order the al-Qaeda soldiers in his midst to surrender. Many of the local Taliban were already eager to give up. At all costs, Dostum wanted to avoid urban combat in Kunduz. Like the al-Qaeda fighters who'd been trapped at Sultan Reza, the enemy soldiers inside Kunduz were fanatical and opposed to surrender. Subduing them would mean another bloody slaughter. For his part, Faisal wanted passage from Kunduz to Herat, about 60 miles west of Mazar, where pockets of sympathetic Taliban still had not surrendered. The usually defiant mullah had a proposition for Dostum. He would pay the Uzbeki warlord $500,000 if he and his fellow Taliban were allowed to travel safely to Herat. After some discussion about the overall plan, the enemies looked each other in the eye and shook hands. They were agreed. The two men emerged from Dostum's quarters and announced to the Taliban and Afghan soldiers gathered below that nearly 13,000 Taliban would surrender in Kunduz. "The fighting of the Taliban is finished in Afghanistan," Dostum happily proclaimed. "They are preparing to surrender to us." Ever the diplomat, he carefully described the surrender not as a moment of defeat for the Taliban, but as a chance for all warring Afghans to be reunited. Dostum realized he was about to vastly enlarge his army, as long as he could convince the enemy fighters to join his side. The Taliban in Kunduz owned valuable tanks, weaponry, and a fleet of beat-up Toyota trucks. That he would be $500,000 richer for the deal had to seem a bonus. The Afghan Taliban would be allowed to join the Northern Alliance or return home to their farms, businesses, and families, as long as they didn't have an affiliation with al-Qaeda. The fate of the approximately 3,000 Arabs, Pakistanis, Chechen, and Chinese, the foreign Taliban, would be decided later. Dostum would eventually sort them out, he announced, deciding who was an al-Qaeda terrorist and who was not. But for now, they would be safe. Faisal and his men loaded up in their Toyotas and delivery trucks and shot off from the fort in a cloud of dust. Bowers watched them go. He didn't like the feeling he had about the meeting. Dostum, it seemed, was suffering an attack of hubris. Bowers would later be surprised to learn that Dostum also believed he might convince al-Qaeda and foreign Taliban fighters to surrender to him. During the meeting, Bowers had found Faisal to be vague about his plans to carry out the surrender in Kunduz, and he distrusted the warlord. Bowers was also unaware of Faisal's cash payment, but there was nothing he felt he could put a finger on. And besides, there was the pressing matter of Kunduz to turn to. Upon returning from his meeting with Dostum, Faisal informed his soldiers that any Taliban who put a picture of Massoud or Dostum on the windshield of their vehicle would be allowed safe passage into Mazar and on to Herat. Faisal didn't mention that at first they would be held as prisoners, and that the local Taliban would be freed, while the fate of the foreign ones was as yet undecided. The foreigners were also led to believe that they likely would be allowed to continue to Herat. Faisal misled them in order to get them to comply. His double cross went further, in the later estimation of Max Bowers. With Dostum pacified by the surrender, Faisal planned an attack on Mazar itself. His payment of money to Dostum had bought him the time and space to accomplish this. Taliban fighters located in Balkh, to the northeast of Mazar, were awaiting word from Taliban command when to attack. Further attacks would come from Taliban soldiers in Kunduz, and from those still hiding in Mazar. While Bowers believes that Faisal was an architect of the Taliban's perfidious surrender, he also suggests, as do other U.S. soldiers, that other rogue actors in the Taliban organization had a hand in the double cross. If they could retake Mazar, then the Americans' battle for the North would be lost, and with it, the battle for Kabul, and thereby the rest of the country. The Americans would soon be mired in conflict through a long, bitter winter. Without Mazar, they wouldn't have access to the Mazar airfield and nearby Freedom Bridge to Uzbekistan, with which they planned to bring humanitarian and military supplies into the country. Without Mazar, they would lose everything. While the surrender negotiations were underway, Diller had worried that he'd be left out of the fight in Kunduz. Bowers, again, seemed to have a sore spot for Diller's team. Sam Diller wondered what kind of action he himself would see if he had to stay behind in Mazar. Not much, he guessed. He couldn't imagine sitting out a fight. To remedy the situation, he knocked on the door of the ranking officer on the ground, Admiral Bert Calland, who had arrived in mid-November as a high-ranking liaison with Alliance forces. The ultimate decision about who would be going to Kunduz would be Calland's. Diller knew he was going over Bowers' head. The move could end his career. Calland was looking through some papers when Diller entered. He looked up. Yes? Diller removed his boonie cap and said, "Sir, there's a fight coming up in Kunduz, and we want to be there. I've heard that we might not get to go." "Nobody put me up to this," he went on. "Captain Nelson didn't ask me to talk to you. So if there's going to be any heat, I'll take it." Calland, obviously impressed with Diller's initiative, smiled and thought a moment. "You won't be taking any heat, Sergeant. I'll see what I can do." After that, Diller and the team were placed on the list to go to Kunduz. That night, Sergeant Dave Betts drove to a helicopter landing zone north of the city to pick up some soldiers newly arrived from K2. These men would help form the support staff at the schoolhouse. Betts was relieved to be receiving more men to supplement the skeleton crew. He was looking forward to seeing his buddy Captain Kevin Leahy. Leahy had been riding out the war back at K2. Now he walked up and slapped Betts heartily on the shoulder. "Old Sarge, how the hell are you?" The two men had worked in adjoining offices back at Fort Campbell, and Leahy remembered the day the news of the attacks in New York City had come over the radio, when he had worried about his brother, who worked for a brokerage firm on Wall Street. Betts had been a steady presence as Leahy waited for the news that his brother hadn't been in the World Trade Center when it collapsed. Not everyone could fit in the van, already stuffed with gear and weapons, so Leahy volunteered to stay at the landing zone with eight other soldiers, while Betts drove 8 British SBS, Special Boat Service, soldiers back to the city. The Brits had arrived to help Mitchell secure the Turkish schoolhouse in the aftermath of the war. Betts was glad to see them, too. About an hour after Betts left, Leahy watched red tracers streak across the horizon, maybe a quarter mile away. That was odd. Leahy had been told when boarding the helicopter that he shouldn't expect to meet any resistance when he landed. He ordered the other men to don their night vision goggles and find cover among the ruined walls of some nearby mud buildings. U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Jason Kubinek hadn't been part of an active combat team like Newman's or Nelson's, but he was hungry for a fight. Maybe now, he thought, he was going to get it. Leahy heard the angry roar of a vehicle approaching, tires skidding to a stop at the edge of the landing zone. 3 men in desert camo, Leahy could see they were Special Forces soldiers, jumped out. Captain Paul Severson and Sergeants Andrew Johnson and Gus Forrest had been ordered by Betts to come back and pick up Leahy and the remaining men. "They started firing at us at a checkpoint," yelled one of the soldiers. "That was an ambush. They're coming after us right now." That explained the tracer fire, thought Leahy. "Let's move the vehicle to the buildings," said Leahy. "If we do that," said one of the soldiers, "somebody could see we're here because of the taillights." "Okay," said Leahy, "then break the taillights." He waited, and nobody moved. Then he realized that some of the guys were hesitant to take a swipe at the truck. Like it was war, but you couldn't break anything, Leahy thought. "Like this," he said, and he raised his rifle butt and smashed one of the lights. Somebody quickly smashed the other. These guys were staff people, not warriors who had recently seen battle, Leahy reminded himself. In fact, he counted himself among them. But he could feel his own fear as he reminded these guys of the seriousness of the situation. "Can somebody get comms with the schoolhouse?" he asked. "Sir," said blue-eyed, blonde-haired Ernest Bates, a 35-year-old sergeant from the Midwest who was fiddling with a radio he'd drawn from his rucksack. "Sir, I can't raise the schoolhouse." Leahy knew he had to get a message to Betts explaining why they hadn't returned already. Bates pulled another transmitter from his bag. "Sir, using this, we can send a distress signal to K2, he suggested. Leahy considered it. "Nah, 'cause we're not in distress yet. Listen, everybody has got to relax." Back at the Turkish schoolhouse, Betts was in fact wondering why Leahy hadn't yet returned. Impatient, he grabbed another sergeant, Bob Roberts, and they jumped into a vehicle, Betts driving like hell for the HLZ. Shortly, Leahy looked up from behind his pile of rubble and watched as a van ripped over the desert road, heading toward him. "Is it ours?" he shouted out. "We think it's Betts," one of the men answered. "Keep an eye on it," said Leahy. He told everybody to be ready to hammer it with automatic fire. The door flew open, and a stout man, silhouetted by headlights, bounded up, sputtering. Betts. He walked up to Leahy. "Hey, sir, what the hell? What are you guys doing?" Leahy snapped. "What the hell? I'm out here and we got guys getting shot at." And then they heard something falling toward them from overhead. Around them, the ground thudded. "An airdrop," thought Leahy. "We're standing in a supply drop zone." They scattered to the edges of the gravel field and listened as the night erupted with shouts. There were people out there, scurrying around in the dark, tearing at the bundles of food and blankets. "Does anybody know who those people are?" asked Leahy. "Locals," said Betts. "They've been raiding our supply drops." "We're going to recon the crowd and see," Leahy decided. He turned to Sergeant Roberts. "Get in and drive, and put the headlights on." Leahy, Betts, and Roberts drove toward the crowd. Leahy watched as the looters stood up, arms laden with bandages, blankets, and boxes of MREs. He stepped out into the headlights and held his hand up in peace. "Salam alaikum," he said. "Peace be with you, brother." Leahy could see the looters were nervous, fingering beat-up AKs. Betts couldn't figure it out. These were local citizens, with some Northern Alliance soldiers in the mix. What was making them so nervous? Leahy decided that he and Betts and several others would make a run for the Turkish schoolhouse. They would have to leave the rest of the group behind until daylight. Leahy wanted to get word to Mitchell that they had arrived and were all right. He wanted to know, what in hell is going on? Part 5. Ambush. Mazar-i-Sharif, Afghanistan. November 24, 2001. Probing close to the city limits, but unseen, unheard, and completely unexpected, a force of 600 armed Taliban warriors, tired, filthy, and wavering on the verge of total physical collapse, had halted in the cold desert sand, about 2 miles from Leahy's position at the ruins. It was these men who had made the local Afghan so nervous. They had walked and driven several days from Kunduz. These were some of the foreign soldiers who had been tricked by Mullah Faisal into believing that General Dostum would afford them safe passage to the nearby ancient city of Herat, east of Mazar, one of the Taliban's remaining strongholds. 6 large trucks sat idling on the highway. Among the Taliban fighters was a young American, so tired he was unable to speak. He squatted in the dust and made a fireless camp, waiting for dawn. Through the night, the Americans in the city could hear gunfire erupting, growing in intensity, as if there were a battle brewing that no one had told them about. At about 3 a.m., Betts and Leahy, back at the schoolhouse, were still trying to sort out why the locals at the landing zone had been so jumpy. At the same time, Dean was fitfully dozing in his safe house when a team member burst in and shook him awake. The team member had gotten up to go to the bathroom and had seen a light on in an office often used by Atta in an adjoining room. The man had thought it was unusual that Atta should be there so late. Dean jumped up from his sleeping bag, which was laid out on a large pillow on the floor. He dressed and pulled on a brown army t-shirt and his hiking boots, and rushed across the courtyard to the general's makeshift office. Atta looked up in surprise as Dean entered. The usually dapper warlord had also apparently dressed quickly and hurried to his office. His brown smock was misbuttoned at the neck, and his trademark hat was askew over one eye. Dean saw the stricken look on the man's thin face, and asked in pantomime, "What's wrong?" Atta had unrolled a map of northern Afghanistan on a table, and he bent over it, pencil in hand, and traced a line along the road from Kunduz to Mazar. "Taliban and Al-Qaeda," Atta said. He ran his finger over the road, leading from Kunduz. He then tapped the map with a pencil around the city of Mazar and said again, "Taliban and Al-Qaeda." "Here?" asked Dean, pointing at Mazar. Atta shook his head. "Yes." Dean stood up. "You're shitting me, sir," he said in English, forgetting for a moment that the warlord couldn't understand him. "You mean the Taliban are here? In the city?" said Dean, pointing at the map. "In Mazar, yes," said Atta. Dean's worst nightmare, the nightmare of all the teams, had come true. After arriving back at the schoolhouse, Leahy bounded up the stairs to the operations center, where he met Major Kurt Sontag. He explained the ambush and nervousness of the looters, and that his remaining men were back at the HLZ, waiting for pickup. He asked Sontag why the friendly Afghans should be so nervous. Sontag said he didn't know. No one at the schoolhouse knew what was unfolding outside the city's limits. Leahy saw CIA paramilitary officer Garth Rogers walk down the cement stairs from his office on the fifth floor. He did not look happy. "We got some Taliban at the wire." Leahy and Sontag shook their heads, not understanding. "About 600 of them," the grizzled officer said. "They want to surrender. They're out by the airfield." Leahy and Sontag also immediately wondered how they would maintain control of 600 Taliban when most of the American combat fighters and Northern Alliance soldiers were in Kunduz. Dean's and Nelson's teams, accompanied by Atta and Dostum, were scheduled to leave for Kunduz within several hours, while Leahy had been assigned to stay at the Turkish schoolhouse. Major Sontag would oversee the schoolhouse staff, while Major Mitchell would coordinate the movement of the soldiers patrolling the city. Leahy set aside his worries for a moment and asked if there was any danger in driving back to the landing zone. "No," the CIA officer told him. "He should be safe." The Taliban had confined themselves to the area near the airfield. In fact, they were asking to be taken prisoner there. Sontag, Leahy, and Betts headed out the door. Leahy jumped up in the back of the pickup, and Betts gunned it. The news of the Taliban had unnerved Betts. Suddenly, the war seemed incredibly close. Leahy had to grab hold of the 50-caliber machine gun, mounted on a tripod on the truck's bed, to avoid being whipped around as Betts tore out of the drive. As they approached the landing zone, Betts saw a roadblock up ahead, a handful of men with weapons standing in his headlights. He slowed the pickup, tires crunching on gravel. Leahy stood in the back, manning the machine gun, as the truck glided ahead. The events of the last 6 hours were untangling themselves for Leahy. He realized that the Northern Alliance had known of the Taliban's arrival earlier in the night, and that this news had spooked them. They had started seeing demons in every shadow. That's why they had fired on the second truck that had come to pick him up. At the same time, the Americans hadn't realized they had just run a checkpoint during a curfew imposed to keep the Taliban off the streets. The fact that news of the Taliban's arrival hadn't been passed on any earlier to anyone at the Turkish schoolhouse, including the CIA officers on the fifth floor, reminded Leahy of how volatile his new world was. The intel had become trapped in some eddy in the rapport between Dostum and Atta. It was impossible to tell how. Betts rolled down his window so the kid at the checkpoint with the AK-47 could see his face and that he was an American. "How you doing?" said Betts. The kid was fingering the rifle trigger, looking uneasy. Betts still hadn't stopped the van. They were already rolling past. Betts was ready to stomp the gas. His eyes locked with the kid's. The young soldier finally waved them through. It was at that moment that Betts knew that something was going wrong with the war as they had been fighting it. The kid seemed to know something he didn't know, and couldn't know, and wouldn't know, until it was too late. What he'd seen in the kid's eyes was fear. When Betts arrived moments later at the HLZ, the men still hiding behind the mud walls were drained from the stress of standing the whole night with guns popping off around them. Staff Sergeant Jason Kubanek realized that the rock his foot was resting on was actually an unexploded artillery shell. He looked around and saw ordnance every 5 feet. They'd been standing all night in a huge field filled with explosives, It was a miracle. No one had been blown up. Now it was safe to get in their vehicles. Kubinek was relieved when they pulled up to the schoolhouse in Mazar. He could now rest easy. At Atta's safe house, Dean marched next door to Mark House's room. "Hey man, get your ass out. We got Taliban in town." House rolled over. "What?" "Wake up," said Dean. "We got bad guys in the city." House dressed in seconds. The day before, he had played a game of bouzkashi at the Mazar field with some local riders. The game involved two teams on horseback, attempting to drag a headless goat into the other's goal. House couldn't believe that just hours before they had been playing a game to celebrate their victory. And now, the Taliban seemed to have returned. He grabbed his rifle and loaded into a truck outside the safe house door. House had pointed to the stock of his weapon with his daughter's name, Courtney, written with white paint. He patted the gun and said a prayer as they sped to the surrender site. John Walker Lind had left Kunduz so quickly, clinging to the splintered side of a truck, that he'd taken no food, water, or adequate clothing. The desert nights had been cold and black, the days dry and blistering. He was afraid he was dying. As the hours ticked by, the memories must have pulsed in his head. Of reading the Quran in a madrasa near a shopping mall in California. Of his mother and father and their divorce. The divorce had changed everything. The family had dissolved. His feelings about his father were complicated. There were men in this camp who would call his parents infidels. His father had announced about a year earlier that he was gay. Abdul had left the permissive environment of Marin County, California, and traveled to one of the strictest madrasas in Pakistan, where the 6,666 surahs of the Quran had been like iron in his mouth, sure and unbending. He had memorized half of them. Sitting in an internet cafe in Peshawar, Pakistan, he had written, "I am Suleiman Lind, eater of much wheat crop, drinker of much buffalo tea." And then he had packed his sleeping bag and left for Afghanistan. That was 5 months ago. Another life. Now, Abdul Hamid had come to surrender in Mazar-e-Sharif. He wanted to go home to California. He did not want to die. When he learned that airplanes had been crashed into buildings in the United States of America, he was dismayed. Why had innocent people died? Abdul feared men like Dostum as much as he did the hardcore Al-Qaeda fighters surrounding him. After his surrender, he hoped that Dostum wouldn't line them all up and shoot them. Following behind General Atta and his convoy of six trucks headed to the surrender site, Medic James Gold pulled his vehicle to the side of the highway, parking beside a primitive wooden arch spanning the bombed-out blacktop. Next to the arch stood a rough-hewn guard shack. Dean, sitting beside Gold, studied the shape-shifting mass of Taliban through his binoculars. They were about a mile away, across the red tabletop of sand. Some of the men's turbans flashed in the sun, shiny and black. "That's a lot of bad guys," thought Dean. Dean wondered if there were Al-Qaeda fighters mixed in the bunch. He studied the men and saw various ethnicities, Pakistani, Chechen, Arab, and the grimace of what he imagined were Afghan farmers, shopkeepers, and doctors conscripted to fight the jihad. Dean knew that these last soldiers hated the foreigners, and given a chance, they'd probably gun them down. Dean got out of the truck and started following Atta up a trail cut into a dune, about 100 feet high, overlooking the plain and the prisoners in the distance. "Walk where I walk," said Atta, turning around. This place is mined. At the top, Dean could see that the desert stretching before them was littered with the rusted hulks of Russian tanks and jeeps left over from the Soviet war with Afghanistan. He asked Atta what this section of Mazar's outskirts was called. Atta said it had a colorful name, the Grave of Snakes. The hilltop was dug with fighting positions. These, too, had been left behind by the Russians. From which Dean saw you could easily defend the guard shack. Next to the shack was a bent piece of metal that could be lowered across the road as a gate. Dean figured the road around the gate was mined as well, and that whoever controlled the hilltop controlled traffic on the road. Atta called one of his men over. He touched the courier by the shoulder and gave him instructions. The man took off, trotting down the dune to the pickup. He fired it up and drove toward the Taliban. Dean watched him drive for maybe 30 seconds through his binos. The man carried no white flag, only a beat-up AK-47, with some cartridges slung across his chest in a battered leather belt. Dean watched as several Taliban fighters moved forward to meet him. The men talked for several minutes, and then Atta's courier started driving back. He trudged back up the dune, out of breath. "They want to keep their guns," he announced. Atta shook his head. "No, they may not." The man headed back down the dune to the waiting truck. Atta turned to Dean. "This may take a while," he said.
Dean was standing on the hilltop overlooking the highway when he heard Lieutenant Colonel Bowers at the Turkish schoolhouse on the radio talking to Dostum as the warlord drove to the surrender site. Dean believed that someone needed to figure out what to do with these prisoners in Mazar and then get to Kunduz as soon as possible. The problem was, it seemed to Dean, that no one was in charge. Dean believed Atta now had control over the surrender, as he and his men had arrived first at the scene. Dean also expected Dostum to demand an equal share in the spoils of the negotiations, principally any of the local Taliban soldiers willing to give up and switch their allegiance. Dean picked up the radio and called Stu Mansfield back at the safe house, saying, "We've got to get the guys together out here." Dean told Mansfield they would need more guns on these prisoners once they turned themselves in. He then tried raising Bowers on the radio to report the situation as he saw it, with the hope that he would relay this news to Dostum and tell the warlord to back off. But as he was talking, the radio went dead. Dean wrapped it with his hand. Nothing. It had suddenly malfunctioned. Now he was cut off from both his command at the Turkish schoolhouse and his team at the safe house. At about this time, Bowers piled in his vehicle and headed for the surrender area. Everybody was about to converge. Chief Warrant Officer Stu Mansfield had been at the safe house cooking a turkey of all things when he'd gotten the call to meet the anxious captain. He'd reluctantly left the bird in its roaster pan and got into a truck and started driving. Mansfield, who back in Tennessee ran a real estate business out of his home and lived a quiet life fishing and golfing when he wasn't soldiering, wasn't easily rattled. He was a bit rattled now. The idea that all of these Taliban had showed up in Mazar was bad news. Riding with Mansfield were Sergeants Walden and Lyle. Lyle had an extra radio. Dean used it to call Mitchell back at the schoolhouse and told them what Atta had explained to them, that he had these Taliban who wanted to surrender, and they were located on the highway, about 12 miles east of the city. From the hilltop, Dean watched as Dostum and his entourage of vehicles appeared on the horizon and roared to a stop at the bottom of the hill. Atta explained to Dean how this Afghan surrender would work. "These men are not going to surrender right away. You cannot surrender," Atta snapped his fingers, "like that. If you do, you will lose face." Dean watched as Dostum and Lieutenant Colonel Bowers got out of their vehicles. Behind them were more people, with cameras and notebooks. Oh my God, Dean realized. It was the press. Dean saw about 100 reporters in all. They were following Dostum. Dean and his team were trapped on top of the hill. Dean was convinced his face was about to end up on the front page of a dozen newspapers. Seeing this, Atta announced that he wanted to meet with Dostum and tell his rival that he had the situation under control. Dean decided he had better follow the warlord, making sure any friction between Atta and Dostum didn't develop into a fight. With trepidation, they descended along the narrow road down the dune, careful to avoid the landmines that Atta warned were planted alongside. When they reached the bottom, Dean pulled his scarf up around his nose and stood apart from the horde, hoping that no one was taking his picture. He watched Atta and Dostum conferring, each of them gesturing to the other, "I'm in charge." Dean realized that there was no way to ensure that there weren't any Taliban fighters in the crowd, men who had stayed behind in Mazar in hopes of slipping back into civilian life unnoticed. Now would be a perfect time for someone to whack two warlords at once. Dean understood the surrender as a complete security nightmare. He could hear the swarm of cameras going off. Click-clack, click-clack. Locusts, thought Dean. Little metallic mandibles just chewing at his anonymity, his safety, his mission. Dean was relieved when the meeting ended without a dust-up, but he was sorely disappointed when he saw that Dostum was going to come up the hill after all. One of the reporters shoved a camera inches from Dean's face, and he batted it away. He heard a cacophony of voices, French, German, Spanish. Everybody in the world was here to report this surrender. Dean and Gold hurried back up the hill. Dean watched as Dostum followed and occasionally stopped to point in the direction of the surrender, which nobody could actually see with any clarity with the naked eye, as the cameras clicked and whirred. Dean thought, he thinks he's General George S. Patton. Part of him marveled at the general's savvy. Dean looked up at the B-52 circling lazily overhead, sketching a hairline contrail. The bomber had been called on station by Air Force combat controller Malcolm Victors, who had set up his radio gear on the hilltop. The Taliban sitting on the highway could look up and see the jet, and know that they were being watched by some very serious firepower. Victors had plotted the Taliban's position, and was ready to call in a strike at a moment's notice. Now, thought Dean, the only thing remaining was to get the Taliban to actually hand over their rifles and surrender. Dean looked at his watch. They had planned to leave for Kunduz hours ago. They were running seriously behind. 2 hours later, the surrender was over. Dostum had agreed to the Taliban's demand that they be held at the Mazar airport. While there wasn't a fence on the airstrip to contain the prisoners, they would have to run a half mile in any direction before reaching safety, by which time they'd be gunned down by guards. From his hilltop lookout, Dean turned to Mark House, his weapons sergeant, standing beside him. You know what? They're not really searching these guys. When the Taliban told Dostum they were surrendering, this declaration was accepted as it always was in the battlefield, at face value, as inviolable. I don't like the looks of it, said Dean. What can we do? It's their surrender. Dean was right. The entire success of the campaign rested on the idea
and the reality that this was the Afghans' war. To change gears now, in the middle of this confusing series of events, would be easier said than done. It appeared to Dean that about every fifth Taliban fighter was getting a cursory pat-down from a Northern Alliance soldier. Dean watched as the Taliban men's rifles were confiscated and piled on the bed of a large delivery truck. Soon there were hundreds of guns lying in a pile. Back at the Turkish schoolhouse, Mitchell had been listening to the negotiations on the radio. He hadn't thought using the airfield was a good idea. But on the other hand, there wasn't a jail big enough to hold all of these prisoners. And then his radio popped to life. More news was coming in. Dostum had suddenly changed his mind. The prisoners were now being taken to Kala-i Jangi, where Dostum had decided they would be held securely within the walls of the fortress. No, thought Mitchell. He recalled the weapons, rockets, RPGs, and rifles, all that ammo, still stored at the fortress. He and his men had never finished blowing them up. After the Taliban surrender at the airfield appeared to be complete, Dean and his team came down from the hill and got in their trucks, waiting to leave for Kunduz. It was now late, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They would now leave directly from the surrender site. Sitting in his idling pickup, Dean gazed over at the newly surrendered prisoners, sitting only about 50 feet away in their own vehicles. Dean was shocked to see the look in their eyes. They did not look defeated. Two of the Taliban trucks pulled alongside Brian Lyle and Mark House, who also thought the detained soldiers looked like men prepared for battle. Atta ordered his men to load up. The plan was to get into positions around Kunduz, a half-moon perimeter around the eastern rim of the city, about 12 miles from the center. From there, they would receive prisoners and call in airstrikes to further convince the Taliban to surrender. A good plan, perhaps. But if they should be needed back in Mazar, where the 600 prisoners were to be housed in the fort, it would be a long trip back. At the Turkish schoolhouse, several hours after Dean and Nelson had left for Kunduz, Major Kurt Sontag was at his desk when he looked up and saw the newly surrendered prisoners drive by. Well, I'll be damned, he thought. That's a first. The prisoners were still driving their own vehicles, headed to the fort. Sitting beside each of them, though, was a Northern Alliance soldier with a gun pointed at the prisoner's head. It looked almost comical. Except, why had they stopped outside the headquarters? Sontag could see the prisoners staring at the schoolhouse, as if they were casing it, as if they were trying to memorize a way inside. Upon hearing that the prisoners were heading to the fortress, Sontag had not had a hard opinion, one way or another, except that Major Mitchell had registered his displeasure about the plan. But both men knew that Dostum would be in charge of these enemy fighters, as they would be garrisoned in his quarters. Mitchell and Sontag would stand by, on an as-needed basis. But Sontag hadn't counted on them stopping outside his building. He realized that he didn't know if the men with their AKs pointed at the drivers were really Northern Alliance soldiers. The whole thing could be a setup for an ambush. He called for Sergeant Betts, who flew into action. "Anybody who looks American, stay indoors," he ordered. A handful of soldiers took positions around the cafeteria, their M4 rifles pointed at the street. Mitchell came down from the second-floor office, worried. "Why have these guys surrendered? You just don't turn yourself in." There were prisoners hanging on the sides of some trucks. The truck beds were piled high with men. Mitchell couldn't believe these men were being brought straight through town.
He realized they'd have to drive past the Blue Mosque and the Market Square, where they could bolt from the trucks. The convoy was led by two Northern Alliance vehicles, and two or three more were bringing up the rear. But to Mitchell's way of thinking, this certainly wasn't enough to contain an outbreak, should it happen. As the truck sat idling, Mitchell watched as one of the prisoners was pulled from a truck by local men and disappeared behind it. There, on the ground, he was stomped to death by local citizens and Northern Alliance soldiers who'd come rushing to the scene. The trucks moved on. Mitchell and his men inside the Turkish schoolhouse breathed their relief. Later that night, a civilian truck roared through a security roadblock on the street outside the schoolhouse, and the nervous Afghan soldiers guarding it opened fire. The truck sped away unhit, as more gunfire broke out around the school. Mitchell's men ran for cover. Some of the windows were shattered as machine gun fire raked the building. No one could tell who the shooters were. The fire seemed to be coming from indeterminate directions, as if the attackers had been waiting to pounce. And then the shooting stopped. Mitchell learned that some of the fighting might have been between Atta's and Dostum's soldiers. He didn't know why they were fighting each other. The situation worsened even more when Mitchell learned that one of Dostum's lieutenants had been blown up in a suicide attack at the fortress. As the prisoners were unloaded from their trucks in the southern courtyard, a video cameraman, working under Dostum's direction, was filming the event for posterity. The man was nervous to be surrounded by so many enemy fighters. These scowling, filthy men did not look like they wanted to surrender. "This is a very bad situation," the man kept saying as he videotaped the scene. "A very bad situation." One of the Taliban soldiers beckoned Dostum's lieutenant over, and when he approached, the man pulled a grenade from his clothing and pulled the pin. The cameraman watched through his video camera as a small pop appeared in the background of his frame, followed by a puff of smoke. At least two men lay dead on the dirt. In retaliation, the guards quickly herded the prisoners into the basement of the Pink House. For good measure, they threw a grenade of their own down one of the square-shaped air vents in the brick foundation. The grenade came tumbling inside from overhead and exploded. When he heard this news, Mitchell feared that the city was spinning out of control. At the schoolhouse, Betts had already enacted the highest security alert, Threatcon Delta, with soldiers posted on the roof and in the windows, guns poised. At one point, someone had pulled up to the schoolhouse in a van, and then the driver had leaped out and run away, not to be found. Betts and Mitchell believed the vehicle was rigged with explosives, and so they called in a team to dispose of the bomb. But after cautious study, the team discovered that the van hadn't been rigged with anything. It felt like a warning. Next time. When Major Leahy crawled into bed that night, he thought of the last phone call he'd had with his wife back in the States several days earlier. "Please be careful," she had said. "I'm the support company commander," Leahy had said. "What could possibly go wrong?" The following morning, the prisoners were led by twos up from the basement of the Pink House and set in the dirt courtyard on the west side of the building. Their hands were tied loosely behind their backs with their scarves. The Arabs came first, followed by the Pakistanis, and then the Uzbeks. Spann and Olsen hoped to methodically debrief each of these men, in hopes of mining a precious nugget about Osama bin Laden's whereabouts and Al-Qaeda's plan for future attacks anywhere in the world. Before them were several hundred angry, filthy faces. As the CIA paramilitary officers marched up and down the ranks of seated prisoners, some of the men cursed the Americans, We have come here to kill you.
Span bent down and looked at one young man, whom he suspected could speak English. He was wearing